under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al Asif, Gaza.
The Islamic Center of England, a registered British religious charity in London, temporarily closed months after its Muslim trustees were removed by the UK's aid watchdog, the Charity Commission, over what it called the trustees' failure to comply with their legal duties and responsibilities and their failure to protect the charity's assets. The commission appointed an interim manager to the charity in early May. That interim manager is Emma Moody, a non-Muslim with the law firm Womble Bond Dickinson.
A charity is there to serve a group of people, its supporters, people who use it, and indeed has to address their needs, their aspiration, from a religious or within their statutory of the charity. And that has been ignored. I mean, it's been ignored because what we are seeing now, appointing a secular, non-Muslim sort of lawyer all the way in sort of north of England to run and to sort of dictate what should happen in a mosque and in a charity, it really is outrageous.
It all started with a warning from the charity regulator over a vigil held here in 2020 for revered Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad, Iraq, in the same year. The man who spoke at the event says no laws were broken.
Sardar Soleimani wasn't prescribed, or the organization he worked for wasn't prescribed, and is still not prescribed. He was sanctioned, financial sanction, for issue of Syria. Now, when somebody dies and you talk about that person, you're not supporting financially the person. He's already dead. You know, there is no issue of breaking the sanction. It's outrageous that a charity commission, an organization we're supposed to support, will actually become so political that actually sort of misinterprets the law.
In the early 2000s, the British government and the Charity Commission initiated a program calling on all UK mosques to become registered charity. And by doing so, critics say, control what those Muslim institutions could or could not say outside of what is lawful.
We reached out to the authorities here, but they declined to comment. We were told unofficially, though, that the real reason behind the temporary closure of the center, done on the advice of the interim manager, was something to do with insurance, which they hope would be resolved and the doors to the center reopened to the public soon. Saeed Purizza, London.
The Limelight.
A year after the Zionist regime killed the Palestinian-American journalist, an FBI probe remains pending, yet the U.S. has gone silent on her death. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept reported, over the last year, Abu Akleh's colleagues have continued to report on Israeli regime violence across occupied Palestine, including increasingly frequent military invasions of West Bank cities like the one she was covering the day she was killed. They have also found themselves at the center of the story. regularly updating the public about the various probes into their colleagues' death while actively participating in global calls for justice. No one has been held accountable for Abu Aghla's killing to date. Last fall, the FBI launched an investigation following a sustained public pressure campaign, including by members of Congress. That probe is ongoing. Meanwhile, the Office of the U.S. Security Coordinator for the Zionist Regime and the Palestinian Territories, the Liaison on Security Issues in the Region, has delayed issuing its own report into the killing. Along with Abu Aghla's family, Al Jazeera has filed a formal request to investigate the killing to the International Criminal Court, whose probe into an array of crimes committed in Palestine has not made much progress since it was launched in 2021. As those probes stall, many of Abu Aghla's colleagues still struggle to cope with the void she left. When Abu Aghla was shot on May 11, 2022, she was wearing a clearly marked press vest in an area with no active fighting between the Zionist regime forces and Palestinians. In the weeks following her killing, half a dozen independent reviews, including one by the United Nations, found that the Zionist regime forces were responsible. Last July, Palestinian human rights groups Al-Haq and the UK-based research agency Forensic Architecture released a detailed reconstruction of the shooting, which concluded that Abu Aghla had been deliberately targeted by the Zionist regime forces. While the killing sparked significant international condemnation, it was hardly an isolated incident. According to the UN report, last year was the deadliest for Palestinians in the West Bank since the end of the Second Intifada in early 2000s. This year is on track to be worse, as Israeli regime forces make military incursions into cities like Nablus and Jenin with increasing frequency. According to the UN, Israeli regime forces have already killed at least 94 Palestinians this year, including at least 19 children, more than double last year's number in the same period. As The Intercept reported last year, the US government never investigated the Zionist regime's killing of 23-year-old peace activist Rachel Corrie, who was crushed to death with a bulldozer while protesting a home demolition in Gaza 20 years ago, nor of 78-year-old Omar Assad, a former Milwaukee grocery store owner who died of a heart attack last year while in custody of a notoriously violent Israeli regime military unit. The U.S. Justice Department's investigation into Abu Aghla's death, which came only after serious outrage at U.S. inaction in the case, marked the first time the U.S. government moved to independently probe the Zionist regime's killing of an American. As a standard with criminal investigations by the FBI, Justice Department officials have not spoken publicly about the case. The Justice Department did not respond to a request for comment. Abu Aghla was not the first journalist killed by Zionist regime forces. In a report published recently, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, documented at least 20 instances of Israeli forces killing members of the media since 2001. Like Abu Aghla, the majority of those killed, at least 13, were clearly identified as journalists or inside vehicles with press in Sana'a when they were killed, according to the report. Many more journalists were injured by Zionist regime forces, which also repeatedly targeted media headquarters. During a military assault on Gaza in 2021, for instance, the Israeli regime bombed buildings where more than a dozen local and international media outlets were headquartered, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. As The Intercept has previously reported, the Zionist regime also regularly detains and questions Palestinian journalists, including 16, who are currently being held without charges. To be a journalist in Palestine is a very dangerous job, said Ammar Al-Duaik, the director of the Independent Commission for Human Rights, Palestine's National Human Rights Institute, adding that journalists also face daily intimidation by Zionist settlers and troops. Al-Duaik, who was colleague of Abu Aghla, said that her killing was a reminder that nobody was safe from Israeli regime violence and that journalists were no exception. He said Shirin was visible in the broad daylight. The troops could see her wearing the vest and yet they shot her, which means that no one is safe and everyone could be a target. Being a journalist doesn't give you any protection with Israeli troops. Nor has being a clearly identifiable journalist led to greater accountability.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tehran is once again the destination of yet another high-profile visit by head of state of one of Iran's leading neighbors. The Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq al-Said, leading a high-ranking delegation, arrived in the Iranian capital on Sunday. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi officially welcomed the Omani leader. The two leaders then held private discussions and signed cooperation documents in a number of fields, including economy, investment, and energy. Prior to his meeting with the Iranian president, the Omani Sultan held a meeting with Iran's vice president, Mohammad Mukhbir. Referring to close political ties between Iran and Oman, Mukhbir said the two countries should increase their economic and trade ties to a level that could match their political relations. Sultan Haytham al-Said's entourage to Tehran includes Omani Foreign Minister Sayed Badr bin Hamad al-Busaidi, who met with his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdollahian. Following their meeting, the two officials held a joint press conference where they briefed reporters on the agreements reached by the two sides.
The documents, which focus on cooperation in the fields of energy, investment, free zones, as well as in the areas of industry.
Iran's foreign minister added that other issues were also discussed by the two leaders, namely the transit of goods, the Ashgabat Agreement, as well as quadrilateral transit deal between Iran, Oman, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. said closer cooperation among regional countries was also emphasized during negotiations between the two leaders. The Omani foreign minister, for his part, noted that the two sides reached good agreements in a bid to further enhance their age-old relations. The visit by Sultan of Oman Haytham bin Tariq Al Said to Iran comes at the official invitation of President Ibrahim Raisi. The invitation was extended as part of President Raisi's policy of deepening ties with countries in the region. The two-day trip marks a significant milestone in ties between the two regional allies. Officials from both countries have said the trip will open new avenues for closer diplomatic cooperation, increased dialogue, and engagement at the highest levels. As far as the economic potential between the two countries is concerned, Iran and Oman are seeking better opportunities to develop their relations. Chairman of the Iranian side in the Omani-Iranian Joint Business Council, Jamal Razzaghi, says Iran aspires for increasing the size of the exchange of trade with Oman to $5 billion. This is possible as there are great opportunities for trade between the two countries. Iran does not view Oman as an economic market, but as a vital strategic partner. The improvement of trade relations has the potential to expand to other areas as well. Iran's ambassador to Oman, Ali Najafi Khoshroudi, says Sultan Haytham Al Said's visit to Tehran will foster an unprecedented level of partnership and cooperation between the two nations. Apart from the economic aspect of the trip, the Omani Sultan's visit to the Islamic Republic is of high significance for the development of multilateral diplomatic relations and a strengthening of regional integration. Prior to his Iran trip, Sultan Haytham Al Said paid an official visit to Egypt, where Egyptian officials were cited as saying that Cairo and Tehran are expected to normalize ties as part of a process mediated by Oman. Regarding the Saudi Arabia-Iran deal, it was Oman that mediated negotiations for 2 years. Oman has also been the chief architect of normalization of relations between Syria and the Arab League. Mediating talks between Saudi Arabia and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement was also another turning point in the history of the Persian Gulf Arab state. In a broader aspect, Oman has for decades been an interlocutor in interactions between Tehran and the West. The country has mediated the release of several foreign citizens and dual nationals. Now with Muscat and Tehran trying to deepen their relations in numerous fields, including political and economic, it seems that regional and international developments are moving toward a multipolar world, something that the collective West has left no stone unturned not to let that happen. The Hannibal Directive, that's the name for one of the most dramatic and controversial murky procedures in the history of the Israeli military. In terms of what it signifies, it's an order that mandates the Israeli army to kill its own troops rather than allowing them to be taken as captives. The order was drafted in mid-1986, just months after the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon. It clearly stated that in case of capture, the main mission becomes rescuing soldiers from the captors at the cost of hitting or wounding the soldiers. Now, nearly four decades after, the measure is becoming challenging for Tel Aviv to conceal its combat-related deaths. According to an article published by online news magazine The Cradle, during the recent five-day Israeli aggression on Gaza, there was renewed controversy over the regime's refusal to acknowledge its human losses in military conflicts with Palestinian resistance forces. The Cradle says Palestinian fighters launched over 1,500 missiles targeting approximately 80 cities and towns. Some of the missiles struck crowded neighborhoods in Ashkelon, Tel Aviv, Ramla, causing significant destruction. Although reports circulated about dozens of deaths and injuries, with eyewitnesses describing scenes of utter devastation, the only published image was the one showing a deceased individual in a settlement near Tel Aviv. Later, Israeli officials admitted the killing of a Jewish settler and a foreign worker, while claiming 74 others were wounded. 1 month prior to the Israeli-Gaza onslaught, Palestinian and Israeli media reported Israel's admission of four officers having been killed in a 2014 operation carried out by Hamas military arm, the Al-Aqsam Brigades. During the operation, the Qassam fighters infiltrated a site near an Israeli settlement in northern Gaza Strip through a 3-kilometer tunnel. Israeli officials initially claimed that the soldiers had neutralized all 12 attackers and did not disclose any casualties among its own ranks. The Israeli regime has a long history of refusing to acknowledge its human losses from Palestinian resistance operations, particularly among its own military personnel. For decades, the regime has been promoting the notion to its adversaries that its soldiers do not die in warfare. But facts on the ground prove otherwise. In November 1982, Palestinian resistance fighter Ahmad Qasir carried out an operation at an Israeli military headquarters in southern Lebanon. Up until today, the regime has refused to admit that the bombing claimed the lives of 141 of its soldiers. Now, decades after the incident, the regime still falsely attributes the explosion to a gas leak or a structural error that led to the building collapse and refuses to acknowledge that despite convincing evidence, it was in fact a suicide bombing that caused the explosion. Ever since that bombing, numerous incidents have happened with Israeli officials maintaining the policy of refusal and misinformation regarding its troop losses. In May 2022, a former Israeli minister disclosed that Officer Barak Sharabi from the Sayeret Matkal unit was killed in an operation in Syria in 1984, contrary to claims by authorities that he died in a car accident. Another one in the year 2021, when Israeli archive disclosure revealed the actual death toll from 1991 Iraqi missile strike on Israel were almost five times the officially stated number. Providing such misinformation has even drawn reaction from international rights bodies, with some of them saying official Israeli statistics should be treated with caution. All what it is the fact that the regime in Tel Aviv is very sensitive to acknowledging human losses, so it established a highly disciplined media system completely subject to the army's narrative. Israeli soldiers are said to get used to hearing the phrase, "He completed the mission and returned home safely," a behavior which has become the subject of ridicule for new armed resistance groups, namely the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade. They said let the Israeli regime announce its deaths in road accidents, falling from trees and adventures alike. What one would easily differentiate, though, is the cause each side is fighting for, one for the liberation of their land and the other for occupying the land of others.
It's a moment that will surely be marked in history books. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad being welcomed back to the Arab League after an 11-year absence, an absence that was forced on it due to the war in Syria by Daesh terrorists, were supported by some of the very same countries present at the summit. Now times have changed, and all countries in the region have normalized ties with Syria. The U.S. support for Daesh terrorists was not so much a quest for democracy for Syrians, as the U.S. stated, but more of an obsession to oust the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. So for U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the rest of the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf, even Jordan, to embrace the Syrian president is surely a slap in the face of the U.S. Just like how Iran and Saudi Arabia reconciled after years of hostility, another colossal event which, according to the CIA director, the U.S. was blindsided by this major development. U.S. blindsided by Iran-Saudi rapprochement surely puts into question the weak level of U.S. intel on the ground in West Asia, but not accepting these realities just makes the U.S. isolated and detached from reality. As such, the U.S. is reacting, and true to U.S. behavior, it is doing so against international law. It has been reported that the U.S. has started to build a new military base in the northern province of Raqqa. When it comes to the U.S. illegal occupation of Syria, there are currently at least 24 U.S.-led coalition military sites spread throughout Syria's northeast. The largest base housing U.S. troops is the Al-Omar Field. The oil field in Deir al-Zour province is Syria's largest and has a presence of U.S. personnel and the YPG-PKK terrorist group. Then there is the Al-Tanf, also known as the Al-Tanf Garrison. It is a U.S. military base, but the territory is controlled by the so-called Syrian opposition in Homs Governorate. Overall, the U.S. is occupying roughly a third, or 33%, of Syrian territory. What are U.S.'s main goals in Syria? Brett McGurk, the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa, said the U.S. had four main objectives in Syria: to reduce violence, maintain military pressure on Daesh, address Syria's humanitarian crisis, and to support Israel. Except for the last goal, the U.S. has not achieved any of those stated aims. The U.S. stated goal of eradicating Daesh terrorists rings hollow. For starters, how could the U.S. not eliminate about 1,000 Daesh terrorists since the year 2016, when they first occupied Syrian soil? That is because they are using these terrorists against the Assad government, with the outdated notion of regime change. There are also reports that the U.S. trains these terrorists to use them in places like Afghanistan or other countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. is also stealing Syrian oil and selling it in the black market to provide finances for the YPG Kurdish forces and also for forces inside Iraq, since, in terms of the YPG Kurdish forces, they had supported them with the promise of partitioning an area for them in northern Syria. But the real purpose of the U.S. presence in Syria, as it has stated, to support Israel with the aim of targeting Iran, who is in Syria with the consent of the Syrian government. Both the U.S. and Israel need a wake-up call. The geopolitical shifts in the region have proven one thing: there is no need for the U.S. presence there. All countries have normalized with each other, except for maybe Yemen and Saudi Arabia, who are on course to do so. And when it comes to the security of the region, after Iran and Saudi Arabia's normalization, there is a united front that has been formed, where regional countries have stated that they will ensure their own security. There may have been a time when countries like Saudi Arabia may have sought U.S. assistance and even paid them to provide it with their security, which also included weapon sales, but those days are over. Also gone are the days when the U.S. created Iranophobia to scare regional countries into buying U.S. weapons, with the false notion that Iran was a bad actor. West Asian countries have realized that it is the U.S. and Israel who are now the bad actors in the region. This warning to the U.S. military by the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Navy, perhaps states it best when he said, "You are damn wrong to be in our region." A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. Countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK special forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, the numbers from the U.S. and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the, I think it's the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict a lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly, now the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq. And obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore, a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And I say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد عودك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
السلام عليكم and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. So, I really welcome you all, Brother Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasser, and Fawad Haider to our today's program. How are you? Fine? Fawad?
Fine, yes, sir.
Alhamdulillah. Hassan, how
fine,
about
sir.
You?
How are
Alhamdulillah.
You?
Thank you. How about Ali Nasser?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
Alhamdulillah. And Hussein?
Fine, sir. How are you?
Fine? All right. Okay, inshallah, in this session, we will talk about Ayah 120, 9 and 130 of Surah Ali Imran on page 66. So, everybody, let's listen once.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وللله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض يغفر لمن يشاء ويعذب من يشاء والله غفور رحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تأكلوا الربا أضعافا مضاعفة واتقوا الله لعلكم تفلحون.
Nice recitation, mashallah, mashallah. Don't worry, we'll be reciting the same, inshallah, even maybe better. Okay, we'll try our best, inshallah, to recite that way. So, guys, let's have a quick and short explanation. Allah Almighty, in these two verses, say, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ولله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض يغفر لمن يشاء ويعذب من يشاء والله غفور رحيم. In the next ayah, يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تأكلوا الربا أضعافا مضاعفة واتقوا الله لعلكم تفلحون. So Allah Almighty in ayah 129 says, to Allah belongs whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth. يَغْفِرُ لِمَنْ يَشَى. He forgives whomever he wishes. وَيُعَذِّبُ مَنْ يَشَى. And punishes whomever he wishes. وَاللَّهُ غَفُورُ الرَّحِيمُ. And Allah is all forgiving, all merciful. In the next ayah, Allah says, O you who have faith, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. لا تأكلوا الربا أضعافا مضاعفة. Do not exact usury twofold and severfold. واتقوا الله, and be wary of Allah, be pious, so that you may be felicitous. Alright? تفلحون. So, guys, whatever you see around you, whatever you see around you, belong to Allah Almighty. Tawheed in Malikiyya, one of the instances of Tawheed it was, yes? Tawheed in Malikiyya, in ownership. So anybody who believes in Tawheed, in oneness of Allah Almighty, he must also believe Allah Almighty owns anything in the creation. You yourself belong to Allah Almighty. So, if this is the case, if Allah Almighty wants you to sacrifice yourself in the way of Allah Almighty, you should not say no. Because you're not yours. You're Allah Almighty's, right? He is the owner, not you. Got it? So He has the ownership. And it's not you who owns yourself, right? It's Allah Almighty who owns you. That's it. If somebody knows Tawheed this way, for sure there will be no excuses for him to like have a stress, have like depression, like, oh, I don't have to go. Allah Almighty wants me to go to fight in the way of Allah Almighty, but I don't want. Oh, this kind of stress, come on, you are for Allah Almighty. Go sacrifice yourself. He has given you this life, He'll give you back in the heaven, inshallah, okay? He'll send you to the heaven. So guys, if somebody believes that way, if somebody believes in Tawheed, he has to believe in the ownership of Allah Almighty as well. Alright? يَغْفِرُ لِمَنْ يَشَاءَ. Allah Almighty forgives whomever He wishes. It's Allah Almighty. He is forgiving. He is merciful. At the end of the ayah, it says, وَاللَّهُ غَفُورُ رَحِيمٌ. So whoever Allah Almighty, whomever Allah Almighty wants, will forgive. Whomever Allah Almighty wants, will punish. But there are also certain beliefs, okay, that Allah Almighty, for example, forgive someone for those cases, in these cases, okay? And some cases are there that Allah Almighty will not forgive. For example, shirk, that we said, inna shirka la dhulmun azeem. Okay, inna Allah la yaghfiru an yushraka bihi wa yaghfiru ma duna dhalik. For example, Allah Almighty will forgive anything else, okay, except the shirk. Allah Almighty will not forgive the shirk, okay? So guys, it's this way. Got it?
Yes.
It's Allah Almighty. But we, yeah, of course, have to ask Allah Almighty to forgive us, yeah, to bless us. This is what we are taught, okay? Allah Almighty asks us to do so. In the next ayah, Allah Almighty talks about an important topic, which is a vast topic, okay? That we'll just pinpoint, we'll explain it shortly, but really you need to refer to the tafsir books, to the ahadiths, okay? To learn more about this. It talks about riba. Riba is termed as usury. So refer to the tafsir books, inshallah, you'll learn about riba, all right? قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي قرآني نبض حياتي. How to learn Quran easy? What is the correct way to read the Quran? What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran? Be with Let's Recite the Quran.
We don't have much time, that's why, inshallah, also it has a vast topic, needs explanation, so refer, inshallah, to the tafsir books. Allah Almighty says, لا تأكلوا الربا. So, totally, it means Allah Almighty says, do not exact usury. Usury is haram in Islam, alright? So guys, let's move on to the tajweed rules, important ones, inshallah, we'll mention, then we'll practice the recitation of Fawad. Ready? Yeah? So, the first point, Fawad will say, وَلِلَّهِ لِلَّهِ. So how to read the word Allah? Can you explain it, Fawad?
Sir, if there's a kasra sound before the word Allah.
A kasra sound so or a kasra haraka, that's
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, kasra haraka. So the lam in the word Allah is pronounced with an ah sound.
With an ah or a?
Ah.
Like لِلَّهِ, Allah, la sound. All right? Next.
Yes. But a dhamma or a fatah comes before the word Allah.
All right.
The Allah.
The word Allah is pronounced.
The lam in the Allah is pronounced heavily.
Heavily with an
like,
ah sound.
Oh.
Good job. Like you say, billah, it has an ah sound because kasra is there. Lillah, kasra. But Allahumma or wallahu. Huwa Allah, qul huwa Allahu ahad.
What if the haraka before? There's no haraka before the word. If it's sakin.
If it's sakin, so put a hamzatul wasl there. Allah. Hamzatul wasl. The word alif, the word lam in the beginning. Allah. It is actually al-ilah. Yes? Ilah. So al you have. Lam is sakin, so hamzatul wasl is there. That's why we use hamzatul wasl. We talked about it, right? Put a fatha on the top of hamzatul wasl and read. So when you put a fatha on the top of hamzatul wasl, all right? So it becomes like you read it with a fatha. So in this case, heavily. If there is another word that ends with a sakin, two sakin letters, you have put a kasra. We studied it when the meeting of two sakin letters, iltaqa'u sakinatayn. We studied it. Yes, we learned it. So when you have, there are different cases out there, okay? Normal case is that when you have like two sakin letters meeting together, put a kasra, yeah, in the first one and read the word. So, for example, especially when you have tanween, يَوْمَ إِذِن نِلْحَقْ يَوْمَ إِذِن أَلْحَقْ يَوْمَ إِذِن ends with noon sakin, alhaq, it starts with lam sakin. Hamzatul Wasl is also sakin. Yawma idhinil haq. You put a kasra there. That's it. Next. Walillahi ma fi samawati wa ma fi al-ard. Ard ra has a heavy sound. Dad has a heavy sound. Jim tells you it's jais to stop here or continue. Yaghfiru liman yasha. Liman yasha, brothers. Whenever you see nun sakin or tanween, the same as nun sakin, plus ya, waw, ra, mim, lam, nun, merge the sound. Insert this nun sakin into that letter. Liman yasha, insert it to ya. Limay yasha.
Idgham.
Limaw, limay, liman, limal, limam.
That's it. Limar qur rabbi. Qul rabbi, qur rabbi. That is also an example for this. So, لِمَيَّشَاءُ مَدِلِينَ also we have أي لِمَيَّشَاءُ Mad is wajib here, Hamza is in the same word. وَيُعَذِّبُ مَيَّشَاءُ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ Look, Tanwin plus Ra, join them. وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رُّرْرَحِيمٌ 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 That's it. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا Ya, the mad is not wajib, right? It's not wajib. It is jaiz. Ya ayyu. Ya is one word. Yeah. It stands for ayyu. One word. Ayyu stands for another word. Ayyuhal ladhina amanu la ta'akulu riba. Riba, also the mad is not wajib. Riba adu'afam adu'a'anu a'afan tanween plus meem. Merge them again. Yarmalun, I told you. Adu'afam mudu'afah. مضاعفةً if you stop تنوين changes to سكون صلة tells you it's better to continue مضاعفة so when you continue تنوين plus واو merge them مضاعفة واتقوا الله لعلكم تفلحون that's it. Ready to recite?
Yes.
Listen and repeat. Brothers and sisters listen and repeat please. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
ولله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض
ولله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض
يغفر لمن يشاء ويعذب من يشاء
يغفر لمن يشاء ويعذب من يشاء
والله غفور رحيم
والله غفور رحيم
يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تأكلوا الربا أضعافا مضاعفة
يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تأكلوا الربا أضعافا مضاعفة
واتقوا الله لعلكم تفلحون
واتقوا الله لعلكم تفلحون
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم
أحسنت ما شاء الله الله bless you we practiced the tajweed rules we mentioned them and we also practiced the recitation that's all from us for today inshallah the next session will continue towards the next verses or ayat of Surah Ali Imran. Stay with IRB English Radio, brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to Fawad, Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasser for being with us. See you inshallah. Nothing to say?
No, sir.
Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadi wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه
تستقيم حياتنا إلا به. هو القرآن والفرقان، إليه تنصت الأكوان، وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
Football versus enemies. Part 2.
Gaining the first international championship title for Iran was an excuse to reveal the people's emotions in the crackdown during the 1940s and 50s. That evening, people took to the streets and were festive all night long. Back then, Iran didn't have proper infrastructure, and a large part of society lived in poverty in the suburbs. Allocating funds for football to showcase the country attracted many people's attention. That trend continued as one of Pahlavi's policies. We can see the manifestations and other events like the 2,500-year celebrations of the Persian Empire. With Iran's first championship in 1946, Iran's golden decade in Asia started. Iran became the champion for 3 consecutive years in the Asian Cup. At club level in the same decade, Taj defeated Israel's Hapoel Tel Aviv in 1970 and won the cup. In the 1970s, Iran's league, named the Takht-e-Jamshid Persepolis Cup, was launched. The most important event in the league was a match between Persepolis and Taj in 1973. The match ended in a historical result, Persepolis 6, Taj 0. The first important derby in the Shah Stadium, which was constructed with a hefty budget for the Blues, ended with a result against the monarchy. No video footage exists from the historical match. Some blame General Khosravani, who was the president of the Taj Club, for it. Murtaza Ahmadi, who was at the stadium and worked at the national television back then, claimed that the little footage there was at the television were ruined by General Khosravani so the monarchy would forget the bitter memory. The match was the beginning for the famous slogan by Persepolis fans. People saw they could crush big powers despite all their facilities. They could humiliate monarchy without being afraid of it, even if the wealthiest and most powerful countries support a club. Persepolis displayed the outcry of the suppressed rage of society against the royal family in the football field. Persepolis turned into a team that targeted the political goals of the monarchy. It finds fans among the people from the poor neighborhoods in Tehran and other major cities, and its opposition to Taj becomes much more important than a sports competition. Those days, Persepolis used to play unofficial matches with local teams so people would pay more attention on local teams. In one of the matches that was secretly held, Ali Parveen and his team went to the Shrine City of Qom and played against a youth team of the seminary school. During the match, Sayyid Ahmad Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini's son, was the defense player of the rival team. The Shah and his family were really interested in football and fervently followed it. Because of the Shah's interest, exorbitant amounts of money were spent on football. However, other sports were in pathetic condition and were not seriously supported. The monarchy always sought to keep the Shah satisfied so they would cause inequality in sports. Under those circumstances, Iran's football reached the pinnacle of success and proceeded to the World Cup in Argentina. But Iranians lacked the experience in major international events, so they failed in the World Cup. The rival team was handed 4 penalty shootouts in the first match, and in the last match, we received an own goal. No one could predict that only 6 months after the World Cup, Iran would be impregnated with major developments. When Iran was playing against other countries in Argentina on the anniversary of the June 5, 1963 demonstration, the administration of Amuzegar stepped up confrontational policies and cracked down on protests and tied the noose around the people's necks. A few months later, the passion of the revolution spread all across the country. Amid the developments, some football players joined the people. This picture shows Mohammad Maili Kohan alongside Ali Parveen in one of the rallies in 1978. After the revolution, everything changed. The radical view against football considered it in line with westernization and Americanization, something that wastes time and an aimless entertainment whose existence at a time when there's no proper infrastructure for a simple living in the country wasn't deemed necessary. Football players were confused. During the months following the revolution, as the government and hence the Football Federation weren't completely at the helm, football was on standby. Everything was changing. 1 year after the revolution in 1979, Iran participated in the Asian Games, and despite all shortcomings and objections, it was ranked among the top 4 teams. Iran had to defeat the mighty hosts Kuwait in order to reach the final. Kuwait was Iran's toughest rival back then, who hosted the games. Exactly the evening the match was being held, Saddam bombed Tehran and stoked the flames of war. The fear and stress among the players was more than ever. Iran, that was still considered the top football team in Asia after the revolution, was dragged into a long and unwanted war that gradually sucked the strength out of society, and football was not a priority anymore. Instead of Iran, that was engaged in a war, Kuwait managed to take part in the World Cup twice.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.